put a restaurant menu in front of me and I'm just about guaranteed to go for the fish option every time. I love everything about fish, its texture, its versatility and its health-giving properties. It is this close interest in that particular food that gives me pause for thought in my reading of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. Here's my problem. Are we to suppose that the crowd had a mass feeding on raw fish and bread? This is what the text appears to be saying. There's no mention of cooked fish or of smoked fish, something of a specialty of the Galilee region at that time. Nor is there any inference that the miracle simultaneously generated any preparation process in what was provided. Of course, we're familiar with sushi, but that has its own minimalist additions. And there is ceviche, but that's cooked by the acid action of the lemon juice you add. But what appears to be on offer in that remote Galilean region is naked, unadorned, uncooked raw fish. We would find that unappealing and off-putting, but they appear to have tucked in with gusto. Why am I dwelling on these culinary details? Because meals and food figure so prominently in the ministry of Jesus. He makes the mass feeding happen in this instance as a compassionate adjunct to his healing of many of the crowd, because, as it says in the New English Bible, his heart went out to them. Hospitality is a big thing in the outreach method of Jesus. It matters because around his meal table gatherings, unlikely, unsuitable, and unusual combinations of people are assembled. The deeply divided children of Israel, whose religious law has made many of them offside with each other, are now reunited in his table fellowship as they listen to his table talk. Before, they couldn't stand each other. Now they're charmed and persuaded by him to get on with each other. Bringing together 5,000 people who have almost certainly never met each other before is an example of this on a large scale. Some commentators have pointed to this ability to draw such a large crowd on a repeated basis as a potential warning sign to the authorities that here was a potential troublemaker who needed to be watched. If he could persuade such a large, disparate group to come together in this way, what else could he persuade them to do by way of mass action? But there is a profoundly theological point at issue here. The crowd scenes that bring together such disparate groups of people to receive teaching, healing, and feeding point forward to the emergence of the church, a future mass community of different culture groups, different language groups, and different ethnic groups, united only by their belonging to Christ. The church, in this United Nations aspect of its nature and existence, is a harbinger, an anticipation, and a first fruits of the future unity of humankind that God so ardently desires. How far we seem to be from that happy state of affairs in our deeply divided world, but God hasn't taken his eye off the ball in what he intends for us. The feeding scenes of 5,000 people and the church operating in a transcultural and transnational mode of existence are hopeful staging points along the way in that future unity of humankind. The church is a sacrament of that, an outward and visible sign of a powerful spiritual aspiration and divine intention. Returning to the food theme, food details matter in the Gospels because Christianity is such a materialist religion embedded in the physical stuff of our world. We are, as one astute Christian philosopher put it, animals who can talk, and we're animals with bodies that need food fuel to live. And unlike most of the animal kingdom, we've learned the skills of food preparation and cooking. Food for most of us isn't just about topping up on body fuel. It's a source of comfort, of interest, and of emotional coloration of our day. Our sense of taste is a sensual pleasure and an affective additive. It's one of the ways we feel our way through the world as we literally take bits of it into ourselves. We think about it a lot. We spend a lot of our resources on acquiring it. And some people give a lot of time and energy to food preparation and presentation. As the Galilean crowd sank their teeth into that uncooked raw fish, it was no doubt healthy for them, but the taste wouldn't have been great. The sensual factor of food wouldn't have applied to that meal, but maybe the crowd was so hungry they didn't mind about it. This was a meal of necessity rather than a gourmet meal from the future world of the kingdom. This raises an issue I've never thought about before. Will there be dining and drinking in the fulfilled world of the kingdom? I assume so, because at the Last Supper, Jesus spoke of doing so. Last Sunday's Gospel reading concluded with a parable about fish and fishing. This was the one about the dragnet that was cast into the sea, where it caught fish of every kind. There was then a sorting out process, where the useful ones were kept and the rest were thrown away. This was about the day of judgment that will precede the fulfilled world of the kingdom. Sometimes parables change in their meaning as the passage of time and the advance of human history brings new dimensions to the way they're earthed in everyday experience. Last year, some parishioners and I went to a fascinating lecture at Otago University given by a visiting theologian who specialises in the ethical issues raised by the way human beings treat the animal creation. He showed us an image that had a brown background with many small curved black bits running through it and asked us to guess what we were looking at. None of us got it right. It was a satellite image of one of the world's great oceans, and the small curved black bits were the gigantic seine nets, bigger versions of the dragnet Jesus spoke of in his parable, being dragged along by multitudinous fishing boats. He explained that the world's oceans are being raped by these seine nets in such a way that not only are the ocean's fish stocks being rapidly and radically depleted, but also the varieties of the kinds of fish are being diminished, as some types of fish are completely eliminated. Human greed and foolishness are not just killing off many kinds of land animals, but also the animals that dwell in the sea. Suddenly, I didn't feel so enthusiastic about always going for the fish option on restaurant menus. My fish fad was part of the problem. There was an urgent ethical dimension to my dining habits. The way we treat the animal creation is part of the expanded ethical dimension that Christians must now take on board as part of their accountability to God. Let me leave you with a final thought. The archetypal symbol of Christianity that is instant recognition from just about everyone around the world is that of Jesus on the cross. That is the way it's been for the last 1,000 years or so. But in the beginning, in the first centuries of the church, Christians had a symbol that only they could recognize one another by, but they meant nothing to their pagan and possibly persecuting neighbors and local law and order officials. It was the fish, that humble, useful, ubiquitous sea animal. The miraculous feeding of the 5,000 that had occurred on a number of occasions had obviously sunk deep into the early Christian consciousness, and the main item on the menu had become something they had identified themselves with. These symbols that Christians can identify one another by, but which are a mystery to our pagan contemporaries, rather appeal to me. Full-time workers for the Presbyterian Church sometimes have an image of a burning bush appended to the upper arm of their sweatshirt. The theological college I attended has a sweatshirt for its alumni with a lamb that has a flag hooked under one of its front hooves, a symbol of the crucified and risen Christ in the same place. Maybe I should order one. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.